We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Good morning, and thank you for joining me for Sunday Sunrise, a public affairs show produced locally by Entercom Phoenix. I'm Minnie Salas, your host. The Walk to Defeat ALS will be held at Salt River Fields on November 2nd this year to benefit the ALS Association Arizona chapter. And this morning, I'm joined by Alex Wadsworth, the development coordinator for the organization locally, and Emily Kudrin, a volunteer on the committee for the walk. They're here to tell us all about it today and about the organization. So how about we start there?
Yeah, so the ALS Association Arizona chapter serves patients and families all over the state of Arizona that are living with ALS. So ALS is a neurodegenerative disease. Neuron cells in the brain stop speaking and connecting to the muscles in the body. And so over time, you'll lose the ability to walk, talk, move your hands, breathe. So we're just here to support them in any way possible.
So is this something that affects older people more or just anyone of any age?
Of any age. So there's no known cause and no known cure, and ALS definitely does not discriminate. We've seen people as young as 16, unfortunately, get this disease, and then late into 70s and 80s. So we've seen all ages.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about how this affects someone. And you said it affects their muscles. Mm-hmm. So they have trouble breathing, they have trouble moving, eating. But tell me how it affects their life in general.
So it affects everything. I mean, you're slowly losing, your independence over time. And then your family has kind of been forced to step into a caregiver role. Mm-hmm. So that's emotionally hard as well. So it's not just the physical aspect, but the emotion, because, your brain, you're still conscious and you're still, thinking, and you're realizing what's happening to you. So.
And you're not really able to communicate all this.
Right. And then eventually you lose the ability to talk, and, that's just devastating.
How slowly or fast does this progress in someone? I'm sure it's different for everyone, but can you kind of give us an idea?
Yeah, it definitely depends on the person. I mean, we've seen people, get diagnosed and within 5 months we lose them. And then there's other people that we serve that have had this disease for 10 plus years. So it just depends on the person.
So is there a treatment?
There are currently two drugs that are approved, but they're not really treatments. They slow the progression down, but there's still a lot of work to be done as far as treatments are concerned, which is another reason that we exist. We give money to research to try to find treatments and then ultimately a cure.
Is there anything that, someone who's been diagnosed with ALS, is there anything they can do, like change their lifestyle, or, does their diet have any effect on how this disease affects their body or anything?
No, unfortunately, just because it does originate in the brain, and then those motor neurons aren't connecting, so there's not really anything like diet-wise or exercise-wise, unfortunately, that they can do to slow the progression.
Which is why getting this diagnosis could be devastating for not only the person that's being diagnosed, but the entire family.
Absolutely, and why it's so important that, the ALS Association is here, funding research, and then also just funding programs like medical equipment, loan closet, social services, and things like that, just to support them during this time.
Can you go into more detail about the programs and the services that you offer?
Absolutely. So we have a medical equipment loan closet, which is probably our biggest program. It can cost upwards of $200,000 a year to care for somebody living with ALS. So we provide power wheelchairs, walkers, ramps, just anything that they'll need to adapt in their homes and then out in public. We've got transportation programs. So a lot of times, like when they're in power wheelchairs, they can't use their cars, obviously, anymore. So we can take them to their medical clinics, and we can take them to the social outings that we have and the events that we have going on. And then we have social programs. So a big one is our adapted recreation program. So we believe that like your life does absolutely not stop at diagnosis. So we'll take patients out to do adaptive fishing, adaptive horseback riding, adaptive water sports. We just did that a couple weeks ago, taking them out onto Bartlett Lake and doing tubing. So we provide that as well. And then, of course, there's support services, support groups for the whole family. Yeah. As young as, you know, we've got children that come to support groups and then caregivers.
So, Emily, you're a volunteer with the organization.
Yes.
What brought you to the organization?
My uncle was diagnosed in 2008 with ALS, and he had it for about 5 years before he lost his battle. Uh-huh. So I started walking somewhere around 7 or 8 years ago, and then they reached out to me to join the committee, and I've been on the committee now for 4 years, mm-hmm. just to continue to support and in memory of his honor, you know.
Tell me how, if you don't mind mm-hmm. sharing your story.
Sure.
You know, tell me about what that was like and how that affected your family when your uncle was diagnosed.
Yeah, so when he originally was diagnosed, it was this, we didn't really know what was wrong with him for about a year. So it was really hard. He was just having a lot of muscle weakness in the right side of his body. After the diagnosis, it was scary. He was angry. Which was hard for the family because we just wanted to help him, but he wasn't happy with that diagnosis. He had a very supportive family, so we're very fortunate. He moved out here to Phoenix from Colorado, so I was near to him for the first couple years, and then right at the end of his battle, he wanted to go back to Colorado where all of his kids and grandchildren were. Mm-hmm. So his son really stepped up. He was the caregiver. He was there for him all the time. We utilized the ALS Association here in Phoenix chapter to help. They actually helped do some respite hours for him early on. And then my uncle was a very avid motorcycle rider, so losing his Harley was very difficult. Mm-hmm. And they set up so that he could ride in a sidecar on a motorcycle towards the end of his battle,
wow.
which was the joy in his face was absolutely amazing. So it was hard on the family. We have family throughout Nebraska, Colorado, and Arizona, and him being between Arizona and Colorado, we had a lot of support, but it was not easy to watch. His mind was so totally functioning, and his body just continuously went out. And he was on some of those medications to help prolong his diagnosis, but eventually, you know, lost that battle. But I think that he went peacefully and he suffered, but he had so much support and love around him that I think it was easier than some people maybe have it.
Yeah. You said that his son mm-hmm. stepped up and became
yes.
his caregiver.
He was the caregiver for pretty much the second he was diagnosed. He moved out from Colorado to be with my uncle and was the primary caregiver along. He was married also, so his wife was also helping, but the son was the one doing the day in and out of everything, especially in the end with the showering and bathing. I think it was more comfortable just to have his son doing
yeah.
it.
Well, I know from, you know, hearing other people's stories that have told me about being a caregiver, that can really take a toll on them too. Do you have support programs for caregivers?
Yeah, so we actually have a specific support group for caregivers that meets once a month. So, and then we'll have activities if they, you know, need somebody to just watch over their patients. So we have that as well. And then November is actually Caregiver Appreciation Month. So mm-hmm. we always do an event in Phoenix and in Tucson, just like massages and mindfulness and things like that, just to give them a day of rest. And then Emily mentioned too, we do have a respite program, so we can provide a monetary voucher to bring someone into the home for a little bit to kind of relieve some of that pressure on the caregivers.
You said you did reach out to the ALS Association Arizona chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about how they helped you and your family.
So I'm a social worker, so I fortunately kind of knew a little bit about the agency, but I didn't really know too much. So when my uncle was diagnosed, I asked him if he had reached out or not, and so he had, I think, gotten information from his primary care doctor about it. he reached out, and then his wife, I believe, used a little bit of the support. It was really the resources that were extremely helpful and those respite hours. I think that there was more that my uncle could have been offered by them, but he was very fortunate to also have benefits through the VA, so he was able to get 100% of everything covered on that end, so he didn't need to use the loan closet. They provided a vehicle for him through the VA, so he was fortunate enough not to have to utilize all of those resources, but we knew they were available should that have fallen through.
My guests this morning are Alex Wadsworth, the development coordinator for the ALS Association Arizona chapter, and Emily Kudrin, a volunteer on the committee for the upcoming Walk to Defeat ALS. And Emily, you said you started walking in honor of your uncle and then started getting more involved. So tell me more about what you do with the organization.
So I've been basically on the committee for the 4 years, and my role is food and beverage. So I help just preparing all of the food and beverage, but then I sit in on the committee meetings every month. Pretty much we start in, I think, January or February up until walk time. And we brainstorm ideas, how to make the walk better, what can we do, how do we get people involved. We do call parties where we will reach out to different captains or other people involved, just trying to make sure we get them registered and going for the walk. So any way that I can help, I try to reach out to Alex and just say, I got free time. Do you want me to send emails, make phone calls? Anything I can do, just take a little bit off her plate and assist on just reaching out to people.
So tell me about the 19th annual Walk to Defeat ALS that's coming up on Saturday, November 2nd, right?
Yeah, so the Walk to Defeat ALS, it's our largest annual fundraiser. We have a goal of $475,000, and those funds go towards the free programs and services that we provide. It's at Salt River Fields this year, which we're really excited about. It's a beautiful venue. We've got a fun, like, one-mile route inside the stadium, inside their really beautiful stadium, and then a three-mile route along their property line. So it's for all ages. Registration is free. If you raise $75 or more, you do get a T-shirt. But, I mean, all ages are welcome. It's family-friendly. We'll have lots of activities and food and beverage, thanks to Emily.
So registration is free. Does that mean if they wanted to sign up the day of, can they just show up?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have a registration tent. If they're not able to online, they can just come up and we'll get them registered. And we take registrations. I leave the link open. So, you know, even if it's the night before, or if you're driving to the event and want to register online, you can do that as well.
So the donations that you do receive for this event, tell me more about where that money goes.
Yeah, absolutely. So most of it funds, like I said, our medical equipment closet. Those power wheelchairs can cost up to $80,000. And there's tons of other equipment that we used. Last year, we did $70,000 to research, a lot of it local. We've got a great research team over at Barrow Neurological. And then also, too, it just goes towards, like, we've got a youth program that it supports and just, you know, our support groups and things like that.
You said a wheelchair costs about $75,000?
Yes.
Wow.
They are extremely expensive. They're great pieces of equipment. I mean, nowadays, you know, we can lift them up so the person can be eye level and then, like, they can recline. So, no. Later in the diagnosis, when it gets towards ends of life, that they don't have to transfer out of their wheelchair all the time, so we can lay them flat. So they're great pieces of equipment, but yes, definitely very costly. And if you don't have insurance, or if your insurance doesn't cover it, you know, that's where we step in.
So these services and programs that you offer are free to the patients, correct?
Free, completely free.
So this is where the donations obviously make a huge difference. But when I think about a $75,000 wheelchair, I mean, you're having to get like some really big donations from sponsors to really make a difference here. But can you give me an idea of what, you know, if someone listening is thinking, maybe I could only make a $10 donation or a $25 donation. That still makes a difference.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell me about how that can be used.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a saying in our office, $1 difference. We don't know what dollar is going to make the difference between us ultimately finding a cure. So, I mean, even $5 will help us buy a ramp, or it will, you know, it goes towards funds to pay for respite hours or transportation. So it all definitely adds up. And we never want someone to think that, oh, $10. I mean, $10 to us, we appreciate everything. And our patients definitely appreciate it, too, that this is considered an orphan disease. So we serve about 500 patients at any one point in Arizona. So just knowing that the community is there to support them and is there in the fight with them means the world.
What is an orphan disease?
So it's a rare, so it's becoming more prominent, but not a whole lot of people get diagnosed with it. So we are just there to advocate. Like, this is an epidemic and this is a really devastating disease, and we need more research dollars and we need more awareness of it.
Would you be able to tell me approximately how many people are diagnosed here annually?
Every 90 minutes, somebody is diagnosed with ALS in the United States.
Wow. Well, let's talk about volunteer opportunities and other donation opportunities throughout the year besides the upcoming walk.
Yeah, definitely. So we could definitely, we need about 200 volunteers to make the Walk to Defeat ALS a success. So if you're interested, definitely visit our website, alsaz.org. So volunteering at the walk is a great opportunity. We've got galas in June that we could use volunteers for. And then also, too, if anyone is interested in volunteering with our patient programs, we could use volunteers for that as well.
Well, Emily, I imagine that being a volunteer with the organization in honor of your uncle is very rewarding for you. But tell me more about your experience as a volunteer there.
Volunteering, the community is great. I can tell you that from the staff at ALS to the other volunteers to family members and to the members' pals, the persons with ALS, the community is supportive. And it's, as a volunteer and someone who's lost someone in the battle, it's just that overwhelming support that you get.
Mm-hmm. Are you okay with talking about why this is emotional for you?
Of course. Okay. Mm. It's a very supportive group of people, and so to have watched somebody personally battle and lose it, it's been hard, but it's just so supportive. You know you're not alone, and to be a volunteer, to be able to be a voice for my uncle, it's just that opportunity. If someone doesn't even know that this organization is out there, someone's been newly diagnosed or they have no funds or no support themselves, maybe, that there are people out there who want to be supportive to you. So it's just been really important because my uncle was a very fun guy. So losing him was hard, you know, losing a really good guy who was fun, energetic. And it was hard watching somebody lose that battle when he had a rough life anyways. So,
yeah. You know, this is just, it's a great reminder because if you've never been around someone who's been diagnosed with ALS, you don't know about the fight that they're going through. But the family members, too, you know, like you said, your uncle was a very fun guy. And to see that there's nothing you can do and he's slowly fading away, I mean, that's got to be painful for the whole family.
That was extremely painful. You know, one thing my uncle told me towards the beginning when he was having difficulty moving, so he would have to lay in bed in one position until his son or wife could move him. And he goes, "Man, I never knew an itch could itch so bad when you can't itch it at all." He goes, "Have you ever laid there and not been able to itch your leg for 20 or 30 minutes?" He's like, "It drives you crazy," because his body couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And so I never thought of it because I've never not been able to do that. But he slowly just lost, you know, the mobility to be able to do those things. He was a smoker, but he made sure that he had his cigarette up until the very, very end. He figured out how to light one or get someone to light one, which is what made him happy in the end. But it was definitely hard on the family, hard because his other kids were also further away. And so they were only there at the very end when it was at its worst. And so the pleasure of seeing that comical side of him the first couple years I got to enjoy, but those last couple years they saw the harder sides, which I didn't see as much as because he wasn't as close. But the family, you know, it was hard for them.
You got to wonder if it's, you know, who it's harder on, the person that's diagnosed or on the family.
Yes.
I imagine it's, you know, pretty equal.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm joined this morning by Alex Wadsworth, the Development Coordinator for the ALS Association Arizona Chapter, and Emily Kudrin, a volunteer on the committee for the upcoming Walk to Defeat ALS, and whose uncle was diagnosed with ALS. Alex, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what you see, the people that come to you, the families and the people that are diagnosed that come to you for services? You know, I'm sure they're all in different stages of ALS.
Yeah, really, I've been working for the ALS Association for 3 years, and it's made me incredibly humble seeing the patients and families that come through our doors, just their outlook on life, just how grateful they are. They're just so amazing, and I definitely wish I could have met them under different circumstances, but it's nice knowing that there's a resource and there's an organization out there that they can call on if they need. To your point, yeah, we see people, you know, who have just got diagnosed, or we've seen sometimes it takes them after diagnosis a little while to kind of accept it, and then they reach out to us. So we just have to be prepared and just be there for them whenever they need.
You know, a few years back, the Ice Bucket Challenge became very popular and brought a lot of attention to the ALS Association. But was it the right kind of attention? Were people really learning more about what ALS was because of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it brought national attention to a disease. Like I mentioned, kind of it being an orphan disease, so not a whole lot of people know about it. Mm-hmm. But now when I talk about my job, when I say like, oh, the ALS Association, a lot more people are like, oh, okay, yeah, Lou Gehrig's disease. They're familiar with it. They related back to the Ice Bucket Challenge. So I definitely have seen an improvement there, just even though, like, the last few years that I've been working here, talking about my work and, you know, our patients and things like that.
Is there anything that the organization is, you know, has in the works or that you'd like to see be added to your programs for the future that you guys haven't been able to implement yet?
Yeah, we are constantly, our staff, we get together at least twice a year to kind of talk about that. And it's grown ever since I've been there, you know, now offering adaptive recreation programs, the youth program for children who have been affected by a parent or a loved one with ALS. So I think there's just nowhere to go but up from here with the services. And then definitely, too, we're looking forward to a future where there are treatments and we can be able to, you know, provide services for people in the different stages and help them with this disease. So
do you want to talk a little bit more about other fundraising events you have throughout the year?
Yeah, sure. So our next big one is called Bite Night. It's our annual gala, and this year it's at the Westin Kierland. And so that's on June 20th. And so that's our gala. And so we bring in about 15 restaurants from all over the valley. So we'll have a live auction, a silent auction, and then we do these things called mystery boxes, which are $50 a piece, and you can get fun. You can get like gift cards that are worth $50, or you can get tickets to Disneyland. And Bite Night's a really fun one to volunteer or participate in. Tickets are $150 each, or $1,500 for a table of 10. And it's the same as the walk, where all of those funds just come back to us and our free programs and services.
Okay, so before we wrap up, can you share a story with us of an individual or a family that's really benefited from your programs and services offered at the ALS Association?
Yeah, we have a gentleman who's really active in our program. He's got children in our youth program, and particularly this stands out to me. We took them on an adaptive horseback riding event, and he got up on the horse, and he was like, this is the first time in 40 years that I've never had so much fun in all the 40 years of my life. And just seeing how happy he was to, you know, be free from, like, the confines of a wheelchair and up on a horse and eye level with people was just amazing. And then seeing his children just sort of blossom in the program has been really rewarding, too, just knowing that they have, like, a safe outlet to talk about their feelings and emotions. And then also, too, with the same gentleman, we were able to provide a wheelchair for him. And so last year he was able to go trick-or-treating with his kids. And he sent us a video, and it was really sweet. So just seeing how not only, like, the medical equipment benefited him, but also, like, our social programs, which are just so important to helping people cope with this disease.
So anything else that you want to let people know about this organization and why support this cause? I mean, there's so many causes in the valley. And, you know, each and every one of them, of course, is very important. But I want to give you an opportunity to let people know why this particular cause is so important.
I think one thing I've learned about ALS is it is not discriminatory at all. So seeing such young individuals be diagnosed, any ethnicity, and from young to old, and how it affects the families. I've noticed after I've had people donate and I say, hey, you know, thanks for donating. And they're like, oh, my neighbor had ALS, or I had an aunt that had it. And, you know, I didn't really even know about it. I feel like I'm connected to so many more people the more that I'm out there. So it's such a great cause. I think so many people have actually dealt with it or been in around somebody who has been diagnosed with it that they didn't really know it, because before ALS was not something as commonly spoke about. And so now, since it's more common and we know that it's hitting people of all different genres, that it's scary because we don't really know fully why it's happening. And so that in itself is just so important, why we need to do more research so that we can help get there to getting that care and treatment for it.
Yeah, I think Emily said it perfectly. We just need more people to be aware of how devastating it is, and that we need more awareness, you know, for research and things like that, just because we don't have a known cause and we don't have a known cure, which is scary. And we just need to be doing everything that we absolutely can to try to find a treatment and a cure.
So give me the details again about the upcoming walk.
Yeah, the Walk to Defeat ALS is on Saturday, November 2nd. Registration starts at 8 a.m. and the walk will kick off at 9 a.m. It's at Salt River Fields. Registration is free. You can register at walktodefeatals.org. You could also give us a call at 602-297-3800, and we'd be more than happy to get you registered and take any donations that you'd like to make. You can also register the day of and make donations up until the end of the year.
And you said registration is free, but you do have a goal of $475,000 this year,
yes.
Right? Well, good luck with that goal this year. Alex Wadsworth is the development coordinator for the ALS Association Arizona chapter, and Emily Kudrin is a volunteer on the committee for the upcoming Walk to Defeat ALS. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, and thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Up next, I'm joined by Karen Jane. She is the CEO for Stardust, and Lucas Mariocker, who is the Zero Waste Coordinator with the City of Phoenix. And Karen, I've had you on the show before, but for those who missed the segment, your organization is doing some great things here in the Valley to reduce the amount of waste that goes into the landfills. And I know that Stardust is also an organization that doesn't get a whole lot of exposure, unfortunately. So tell us more about it.
Well, Stardust is a nonprofit organization. We provide quality reclaimed material for reuse, and we operate two reuse centers in the Valley and also provide donation pickup services and deconstruction services.
And tell me how this got started.
We were founded by Jerry and Debbie Bisgrove, who own the Stardust Companies and the Stardust Foundation, and they were remodeling their home in Paradise Valley, and they told their friend she could take whatever she needed from the house. They went away for the weekend, and when they came back, she had actually gutted the house. And they said, well, my gosh, what do you do with all the material? And she said, well, I put some of it in my own home. I gave some of it to people in need, and I sold some of it to folks I know. Mm-hmm. And so Debbie looked at Jerry and said, what do we do now? And Jerry said, well, I think we've got the makings of a great nonprofit. And that's how Stardust was born.
And this probably saved them a lot of money, too.
It does. Deconstruction and product removal will save thousands of dollars when you're doing a renovation.
Now, it does take some time because you can't just tear things down. You have to be very careful when you take them down, right?
You do. We have teams, deconstruction teams, that will go into homes or businesses and remove the usable material. They gently salvage it so that it can be reused. Average kitchen takes a couple hours to do. A whole house will probably take a couple of days.
So how long ago was this?
This was 22 years ago.
22 years ago. Wow. So you've been doing a lot of this since then. Can you tell me approximately, you know, how many homes you've taken apart?
We do about 1,000 deconstruction jobs a year.
Wow.
So 22,000.
Now, is everything salvageable?
We do scrim deconstruction, so we don't do the full scrape. But everything that we take is generally reusable. And I think people don't really realize how much is reusable from a typical remodel. Cabinets are generally reusable unless there's water or mold damage. Appliances, windows, doors, light fixtures, plumbing fixtures, countertops. We don't do flooring or like drywall removal. We won't take that sort of thing. But Everything else is really easy to remove for our teams. They're well-trained, and they'll leave the home or business in broom-clean condition.
So how do you find, are these volunteers that are doing this? Or
no, it's paid staff. Yeah, we have two teams of two people each. They're paid staff that go out and do the deconstruction work.
So we'll come back, because I know there's a lot more that we could tell about all this here. But I want to introduce you into the conversation. Lucas, thank you for coming in. So tell me how the two of you got together.
Sure. So probably about a year ago, I have bad memory, but I think it was about a year ago, Karen had reached out and wanted to have conversations about how some of the cities locally could be, help and be involved in deconstruction. And so I work for the City of Phoenix as a zero waste coordinator. Part of my job is to educate the community and public about the programs we offer. And so when she came to us, I was like, this is a great opportunity. What we do in the City of Phoenix, the Public Works Department, we serve about 400,000 customers. We haul away the trash, and recycling is a big part of our job. And so this program fits right into our business model. So, you know, if you go back to reduce, reuse, recycle, the most important things are to reduce and reuse first before you recycle. And so deconstruction is, you know, that to a T. And so we thought, why not partner and establish a deconstruction program in Phoenix, a voluntary program that if residents are coming in to get permits to demolish their house, why not offer them an opportunity to divert that stuff from the landfill? And so that's another benefit, is it saves space in the City of Phoenix's landfill. So landfill space will run out eventually, whether that's in 10 or 100, 200 years. And so this is another offshoot benefit, is that it'll preserve space in our landfill.
Do you find that, because Karen, you kind of touched on this when you said a lot of people don't know what can be reused. Do you find that it's really more about education, you know, that is probably part of the problem?
Yes, I think, and we were just having that discussion before we came in, is that I think this program has a lot of potential. I think people just need to know about it. And so I think a lot of people don't know what even deconstruction means. And so I think that's where a lot of the local cities can help out. Organizations like Stardust, as we can get the message out, we can help incorporate the programs into our city business and have information available so that when the residents come in, or those businesses or the contractors, you know, they have the information right there and ready so that they can make the decision. Oh, this makes complete sense. It's only going to take a day or less. Let's get them in there, get this material out, and put it back into the community where we can sell it at a discounted rate for our residents.
Do you find anyone that is not for it? I mean, I can't see why somebody would not be, but the only reason I could imagine that somebody would say, no, I don't think I want to do it, is because it takes a little more time?
It really doesn't take too much more time, especially, you know, just a traditional kitchen takes about 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Demolition would probably take about the same amount. Mm-hmm. So for the homeowner, it really saves a considerable amount of money. Demolition on a typical kitchen can cost anywhere from $15,000 to $2,000. We charge a nominal fee for our deconstruction of $200. Mm. So people are saving a considerable amount of money. They're also helping the community, because these reusable materials are available for folks who would like to maintain their homes, keeping their homes safe and secure, and their neighborhoods are much better improved. And then it also helps the environment, as Lucas was mentioning. It keeps a considerable amount of usable material out of our landfills.
Yeah. So other than something like this, you know, this show, how else are you educating the public and letting them know about what it is that, you know, both of your efforts are doing?
Yeah, so from the City of Phoenix, we're probably a month out from being able to essentially go live with the program. So we'll have a website or a web page specifically on the public works side of things dedicated to deconstruction that'll kind of direct link them to Karen's website that she's designed. We'll have a brochure down in our planning department. And then we'll like to, you know, probably do quite a bit more media around it once it's live. So we're hoping that through that and through messaging, we can get the word out. But there's more opportunities, and we're working on those.
Well, speaking of websites, do you want to give the website address?
Yeah. So Stardust website is stardustbuilding.org. But we've also formed a website called reusearizona.org. And that website lists all different types of reuse organizations, including organizations that deconstruct. And then there's also an educational video that we're sharing with cities and also the state that they can use to educate folks on deconstruction. And it talks about waste in our community and how deconstruction can benefit both the community, the homeowner or business owner, and also the environment.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about the recipients that are receiving the older materials.
So the salvage materials that Stardust removes goes into our reuse centers. There's one in Mesa and one in Glendale. And anyone can shop in those centers. And we also have contractors that come and drop off material that they've deconstructed. So we get a lot of different donations from all different sources. And that material is available to the public. They can come in and shop in any one of those locations. And pricing is about 50 to 80% off what you'd pay in a regular retail store.
So you're probably getting something different every day.
Yes, changes all the time.
Yeah.
We got a lot of regular shoppers that'll visit us two or three times a week just to see what came in.
Do you also work with, because I think you mentioned this last time, correct me if I'm wrong, but you work with nonprofits also to refurnish their buildings?
We do. We partner with several other nonprofits when they have material resource needs through the stores. We give nonprofits a discount when they purchase. And also in our Gifts in Kind program, we distribute usable material to other organizations through that program.
Karen Jane is the CEO for Stardust, and Lucas Mariocker is the Zero Waste Coordinator with the City of Phoenix. So tell me about the different ways that our listeners can support the organization. I mean, maybe they don't have a home that they're remodeling, but they want to contribute somehow.
They can always donate their reusable material to Stardust, or just to help everyone, they can donate their reusable material to other reuse organizations. They can go on reusearizona.org to find those organizations, whether it be clothing or small appliances or building materials. There's lots of different resources on that website that help both Stardust and other organizations and really help our community at large.
Are you ever in need of monetary donations?
Certainly. We're a nonprofit organization. Yeah. We can always use monetary donations, but we actually are self-funded through the sale of the reusable material. So material donation is really the strength of our organization.
Right. How about volunteers?
Volunteers are always welcomed in our organization, both in the stores and also in our Gifts in Kind program.
So other than teaming up with Stardust, you know, tell me about some of the other things that your department works on to not just educate the public, but to encourage them to reduce, reuse, and recycle.
Yeah, so good question. So at a higher level, the City of Phoenix has kind of made a public statement that we want to divert 40% of the waste generated within the City of Phoenix from the landfills by 2020. And so that was an initiative that got kicked off back in 2013. We were diverting about 16%. And so when I say diverting, essentially that means it's going to recycling or there's reduction or there's reuse instead of sending the materials to a landfill. So we started off at about 16% diversion. Just this past fiscal year, we hit 36%, so we went up quite a bit, and so we have only 4 or 5% left to get to 40%. So a lot of these programs, like deconstruction, we have a composting program. We have a series of other programs. Obviously, we have a very robust recycling program will contribute to us getting to that 40%. So we're all in towards getting to that diversion goal, and then, you know, after that, we have some more ambitious plans. But education is only one part of it. We also need a lot of participation by the residents. And so that's, you know, part of my team's job is to get out there in the community. We do tabling events. So any, you know, given weekend, we could be out there tabling at a local community event. We do presentations for the public. And we also do free tours of our transfer stations and our recycling facilities. So if residents are interested to kind of see how that recycling process works, we offer those essentially every week of the year. One of our facilities is shut down right now for upgrades, but we have other ways where we can, you know, help get the, you know, that message out and get the tours available, whether that's through a digital mean.
So recently, I believe it was the City of Surprise that suspended their recycling program, and I think the City of Mesa is considering it as well. How does that affect the City of Phoenix, and does it set you back in any way? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, so you're right. So there's been, I'll talk a little bit. So there's been Surprise, I believe, have postponed or canceled their program, at least for now, and then Casa Grande, and there's a few smaller cities on the outskirts of Phoenix as well. And so really the challenge is that the commodities market, so what's happening is the commodities, and maybe I should back up a little bit. So China a couple years ago had made a decision, and they call it the national sword, and they've said that they want to clean up their country and clean up their skies, reduce pollution. And so that's a good thing. And so the offshoot of what happened there is it kind of they put up a border and they don't want the world's garbage and recyclables anymore. And a lot of, to be fair, a lot of the stuff that the countries were sending them, including the United States, was not very clean recyclables. So, what is that? That has created is it's created this glut of material all over the world where it has nowhere to go. So the demand for the material is gone down, and then so that's affected the commodities market. So the ability for us to sell materials at good prices has been very difficult.
Yeah.
So now what we can sell the materials for is much less than two years ago. And so the smaller cities have been hurt much more than us because they don't have facilities. So the city of Phoenix owns our facilities, and so we can produce. And then the volume we go through is much more than some of these smaller cities. So that's the challenge, is that it's become a little bit more cost prohibitive to you know, process your material. It's more expensive than it is to sell your material. So that's where you're having some challenges with these smaller cities. But we're doing okay. I think the best thing we can do, and the best thing I can tell our residents, is make sure you're putting the right thing in the bin. So what happens is we get a lot of, I'll say residents or people that, they call them wishful recyclers in our industry. And so, and I think I, to be fair, I was probably one of those people before I got in this industry. I said, well, I don't know if this is recyclable, this bike wheel, but you know, it's metal and I think it is. Let's just put it in the bin and see if the city can actually recycle it. And the problem is that gets to our facility and we have to sort through it. And then it could be unsafe potentially for our workers, because anything that goes through our recycling program, it will get sorted by humans first. And so they'll have to pull that off the line. But if they don't have the time to pull that off the line, it'll get into like a disc screen, which is a metal axle with rubber stars, and it spins really fast. So that'll get jammed up in the machine and it causes the facility to shut down, costs us time and money. So the best thing we can do to ensure the sustainability of the recycling program is to make sure we're putting the right stuff in the bin.
Yeah, which takes a lot of education.
It does, you know,
something like this here to let the public know about what you can and can't recycle. I do want to touch on that a little bit before the end of the show, but can you give me an idea of, because you mentioned this earlier about how we're running out of space, or at some point we will completely run out of space. How much space are we saving by something like what the organization Stardust is doing? You know, I mean, these are big items, cabinets, and, you know, when people remodel their kitchens and bathrooms, I imagine a lot of that takes a lot of space in the landfills.
Yeah, so great question again. I don't have the exact number, so it'd be hard for me to say exactly how much time we're saving or landfill space we're saving, but and maybe you can speak too, because I know you know more about the general deconstruction industry. There's hundreds of thousands of tons.
So nationally, in 2013, the EPA did a study, and unfortunately, there's not a lot of data. It is something that we have on our list of things to advocate for, is better data collection for construction and demolition debris. But nationally, in 2013, the EPA stated that 500 million tons of construction and demolition debris nationwide goes into landfills. And they estimate about 75% of that is actually usable material. Mm-hmm. So we don't have data on Phoenix or even Arizona, but it is something that we're working on. And it's something that's really needed to understand the scope of it so that people can understand the impact that they're making when they deconstruct or reuse in general. We divert about 5,000 tons of usable material from the landfill every year. And so, it can be pretty significant in terms of there are quite a few landfills in our metro area. They don't all take construction and demolition debris, but eventually they're going to fill, and then we're going to have to find other spaces, and eventually that's going to encroach on where people are living, or people are going to want to live further out, and that's where the landfills are.
So. Yeah. So, I mean, this is great for Arizona, but do you know if there's anything like this anywhere else in the country?
There is. Nationally, there's an organization called Build Reuse that has a considerable number of building material reuse organizations associated with it. There's not a lot of us, but there are several of us.
Do you work with any of those other organizations?
We do. And we actually have a presence at the national conference that's coming up the end of this month. And we'll be giving a presentation about continuing to advocate for building material reuse.
So I think we talked about this the last time you were on, and about how all these shows on like HGTV, you know, where they love to just take a sledgehammer to things and start, you know, tearing things down. But are you seeing that with organizations like this, you know, hopefully they're coming in and saying, hey, wait, there's another way to do this. Are you seeing a change in that at all?
A little bit. Some of those shows are starting to reflect that they're removing the material and it can go to a nonprofit organization such as Stardust. But I think there's a lot of work to still be done. Mm-hmm. Stardust would love to have conversations with contractors who want to focus on reuse, whether it be on the removal or actually on using the removed material in renovations. It'd be great to see curriculum in technical schools about reuse remodeling as another way to grow this industry. And as Lucas said, reduce and reuse are much more appealing and effective. Recycling takes a lot of energy and costs quite a bit of money.
So what's in the works for the future for both of your organizations, either to educate or to expand on what it is that you're doing? Do you have anything, you know, in the works right now that you can talk about?
Well, for Stardust, we're continuing to advocate for reuse and working on this educational campaign to get the word out. And I don't think we'll ever stop doing that. I think that it's really key for people to understand that maybe their kitchen isn't what they're looking for, what they want, or they're ready to remodel. Those materials can go back into the community and help others. And deconstruction is a simple way to do it, and it's easy. They can check out our website or other websites, look at reusearizona.org, and see the other folks that do deconstruction. And it's a really simple process. We're also going to continue to share out the video that helps educate people about deconstruction and work as a part of the national presence to really educate the nation on how important this is.
And so from the city of Phoenix's perspective, we do quite a bit. So we have, you know, we have over 1,000 employees in our public works department. And I think our challenge is actually we don't have enough time to promote all of our programs effectively. But what we do, at least through my team, is we're doing, again, those tours of our facilities. We do the presentations for in the schools and we do those community events. So through those face-to-face engagements, we're educating about 20,000 people a year. And then we do a lot of marketing and I do Channel 3 segments on the weekends once a month. And so we're always looking for opportunities. So if there's opportunities out there, we're happy to come on and join those. But there's so many different programs. We're just trying to get the word out about our recycling right now in terms of, you know, keeping the contamination down, because that's really one of our biggest challenges is what we're getting is we've done studies and over 30%, 25 to 30% of what we're getting is actually non-recyclable stuff in our curbside, in our alley containers. So the more we can get the word out about that, clean that up, then we can focus on these newer programs. But we're doing a lot with Karen with this. Hopefully in the next month we'll have this program live and be talking about it a little bit more.
My guests are Karen Jane, CEO for Stardust, and Lucas Mariocker, the Zero Waste Coordinator with the City of Phoenix. And I'm sure that, like you said, you're getting a lot of stuff that's not recyclable in the recycling bins, and you're probably getting a lot of stuff that could be recycled in the trash bins.
Yes. So
can you talk a little bit about some of the things that you do see a lot of that is being thrown out that could be recycled or that is being put in the recycling bin that needs to go in the trash?
Yeah, so when I started 3 years ago, I remember vividly because I didn't think it was a problem, but I did a ride-along with our truck driver. So I was in the truck with the guys and the girls picking up the curbside recycling. And almost every third to fourth household had bagged material in the recycling bin. And so if you don't know, you're not supposed to bag your recyclables. And so all of that material that was bagged most likely wouldn't have never been recycled. And so all the stuff that comes to our facility, it goes puts on a conveyor belt that's moving really fast. And the workers, they have a split second to make the determination whether or not something is recyclable. So if they see bag materials, if they can't see through that bag, or even most of the time, even if they can, they have to pull it off the line and it'll go back to the trash side. So the biggest thing I seen when I started, it was bagged recyclables. So it's a big no-no. So we've been educating for the past 3 years. Almost every other social media post is do not bag your recyclables. And then on the same topic, plastic bags are a huge challenge. I think a lot of residents still think those are recyclable. So those are acceptable at your local grocery store or retailer. So even like a Target or Best Buy, Kohl's, those stores will actually take those. If you walk in the store right on the right, the left or right, usually have a bin right there. But those aren't acceptable curbside. So what happens is those, they actually come to our facility and they get wrapped up around those same disk screens. And then so once, you know, a couple, you know, 10 to 20, 30 of those get wrapped up, they shut down the whole facility and they have to cut those out with knives. It's a very unfortunate thing because the workers, you know, it's not safe and they're using knives. It's a very archaic process to get those, and it takes time. So no plastic bags, no bagged recyclables. And in terms of what you can recycle, really, we're trying to go back to the basics. I think we've been trying to do that for a while now. But your aluminum cans, your plastic bottles, your jars and jugs, your laundry detergent containers, your milk jugs, cardboard, paper, magazines, newsprint, stuff like that. But anything outside of that, really, I think, again, back to the wishful recycler, it's better to focus on what's acceptable. And so we have a really cool resource, a new resource on our website. If you go to phoenix.gov/recycle, we call it the Zero Waste Assistant. So it's more of, it's a common term would be, it's like a Google search for like recyclable items. So you can go on there and type in like, let's just say plastic bottle and say, put that in your recycling bin. But if you type something in that's not in there, this is another cool thing, it'll say, suggest that item to staff. And so it'll actually come to us. Mm-hmm. And on the back end, we can add that item to the database. And then so we get a ton of requests, and very random requests too, but a lot of times if we don't have it on there, we'll add it, and so that we can actually interact with the residents through that that app.
What is the website again that you just
gave? It's phoenix.gov/recycle. And then so there's like, it's a widget, and so you can go on there and you can do the Zero Waste Assistant. So you can search for, if you don't know what's recyclable, you can search and it'll tell you what to do with it, and also tell you if it's not to put it in your trash or if you have a curbside organics bin. And then we have a game. So if you click in the same widget, if you click on the next tab, there's a game and you can actually pull items into the bin and you get points or you get rewards. It's kind of cute, but it actually, the kids and adults.
But it's very educational.
It's very educational, and a lot of people, and actually helps us too, because we get all of the metrics on the back end, so we can see how many mistakes the residents are making, and then we can kind of direct our messaging.
That they're making in real life too, probably.
Yes. So it's been very helpful.
So, you know, in the last 5 minutes or so that we have here, what do you want to let people know about the organization and about both efforts, about just keeping things out of the landfill? What do you want them to know? What can they do today to make a difference, and anything else that you want to add?
I think what's really important is that deconstruction is a viable option for people who are remodeling, and that there are just three great impacts when they deconstruct. One is that they save a considerable amount of money in their project. They also help the community by putting usable material back to use, and they save the environment by keeping usable things out of the landfill.
So if people want to find out more again about Stardust, give me that information.
They can go to stardustbuilding.org. If they want to find more about reuse, they can go to reusearizona.org.
And anything else that you want to add that we haven't touched on too?
No, I just say, similar to Karen, you know, we're going to be rolling this program out here, a voluntary program here in a month or so. So if you're a resident and you're considering demolishing, or you just bought a house and you're trying to remodel it, I would recommend at least considering it. And our information will all be live here, hopefully in the next month. And then again, if you need recycling information, phoenix.gov/recycle. And if you just need to, if you want to come take a tour, you want my team to come out and do a presentation for your neighborhood association, or come table at your event, you can just get a hold of the Zero Waste team, phoenix.gov/zero waste. Or if you just want to call the city and find us, just say, I want to talk to the Zero Waste team, and they'll get you to me.
Well, Karen, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you want to make sure our listeners are aware of with your organization?
I think there were two things. When you asked me about volunteers, we are always looking for people who are passionate about reuse to join our advocacy task force. So if there's anyone that's interested in that, they can get in contact with me or check out our website. It's under our board service tab. And we also provide tours of our reuse center in so if they're interested in seeing what we do up close and personal, we'd be glad to give them a tour.
And then give me again the locations if people want to shop for the material too.
We have a reuse center in Mesa and also one in Glendale, and both those addresses are on our website.
And are they open just weekdays or?
They're open Monday through Saturday from 8 to 6 and Sunday from 10 to 4.
And Lucas, anything you wanted to end with?
So Karen and Stardust are one of the companies that we've added to our brochure and our webpage, but we also have Harvest Eco Salvage and Habitat for Humanity. But we are actively soliciting. If there are businesses out there that participate in deconstruction, we would be happy to add them so they can reach out to us again, phoenix.gov/zero waste, and then we would add that, we can add them to our website and our link so that we can promote other businesses as well.
Karen Jane is the CEO for Stardust, and Lucas Mariocker is the Zero Waste Coordinator with the City of Phoenix. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you. Thank you.
And finally, I'm joined by Becky Bell Ballard, CEO of Rosie's House. Thank you so much for coming in again. So tell me about the organization, how it got started.
Sure. Rosie's House is a nonprofit organization. We were founded actually in 1996 by our founder, Rosie, who had the amazing vision to create a place where children, neighborhood children, could come after school and receive free music lessons. So our entire mission as a nonprofit organization is to help youth realize their creative and personal potential through the power of music education.
And tell me a little bit more about Rosie herself.
Yeah, she is an amazing visionary woman, Rosie Schurz. She's still with us here in the Valley, but her story is so powerful. She had to flee Munich during World War II, and in doing so, and this was when she was a very small girl, about 7 years old, and in doing so, she had to leave behind her violin. And because of the war and everything that was happening at that time in the world, she didn't have the opportunity to pick back up the violin. And that was something that she always regretted as a child. And as an adult, she had the opportunity to reconcile those feelings. And so how she did that was to create a place where children who were experiencing disadvantage would have the opportunity to have music in their lives.
So tell me about the programs that you offer there and about the educators and how, you know, are they volunteers? Are they staff? How do you select them?
Yeah, so our educators, we have a team of 24 music educators. They are professional music educators. We are very laser focused on having high quality programs. And so the biggest expense for us actually is paying our music educators and making sure that we have the best team possible. They are wonderful. Many of them teach in local schools such as Arizona School for the Arts and other district schools here in Phoenix. And the one stat that I want to share is that 92% of our music educators have their advanced degree on the instrument that they're teaching at Rosie's House. Mm-hmm. So it's a great team. In terms of our programs and classes and curriculum, we do it all in terms of classical and multicultural music education. So to tease that out a little bit, we provide music lessons in strings, so violin, viola, cello, and we have a string orchestra and string chamber orchestra. We provide music education in piano, everything from our group class for our beginning students to one-on-one instruction in piano, and that's one of our largest programs. Mm-hmm. We also provide music education in choir and singing. So we work with students from ages 5 to 18 in the choir program. We have 4 different choirs, and that allows the students to work through the whole curriculum as they're going through K through 12. In addition, we also have a wonderful band and wind program where we also have ensembles that the students participate in, as well as have the opportunity to have one-on-one lessons. So if you think about band, which is, of course, my favorite thing, so you have the French horn, you have the trombone, you have the clarinet, the saxophone, the flute, and percussion, all making up the band ensembles on our campus. In addition, we also have a wonderful program that we started in 2012 in response to some survey work that we did with our community. And we have a mariachi training program that has 3 ensembles, beginning, intermediate, and advanced. And that is a fabulous program, really vivid, exciting opportunity for students on our campus. And then finally, we also have a digital music lab program where students can learn about making music with electronics and computers, and how to compose and create their own music.
Wow. So for the future producers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's awesome. So tell me, who is this open to? What age groups? And, you know, do they have to pay for this? Do you recruit the students? Do they come to you? Are they referred?
Great question. So our mission is to eliminate barriers to high quality music education. And so we are 100% free for our students. We're one of the largest free programs in the nation, and we really believe strongly in access for all students. And that's really why we exist. That's the problem that we're trying to solve in the community, is that many of our schools, unfortunately, do not have music education and that opportunity for the kids. And so Rosie's House is a place where they can have that opportunity. So we work with families that are coming from a place of economic disadvantage. How we qualify folks is through the HUD guidelines for low-income housing, and all of those numbers in terms of what the household income needs to be are on our website, rosieshouse.org.
Do they have to know how to play an instrument already?
So we work with students who have never played a musical instrument or have never been in a choir, so from the beginning level to the very advanced level. And we have, we like to say, on-ramps at various times in a child's music education that they can come and be a part of our program, either at that beginning level, or if they audition at an intermediate level, we have ensembles that they can go into, or if they're at that advanced level, there might be opportunity for one-on-one instruction.
Well, since I know a lot of the schools are cutting those music programs, I can't imagine how else they get that exposure unless they get it at home with their families. Mm-hmm. But with a lot of low-income families, I can't imagine that they can afford those instruments.
That's a great point, and that's really why we exist. We think that, you know, there's so much creative potential in the world, and that every child should have the opportunity to express that creative potential. And we really feel like the future storytellers and artists and musicians should come from all different backgrounds, not just those that have had the privilege of having high quality programs in their schools or through other means. So we really feel strongly about equitable access to music education.
Where are you located? You're here in downtown, right?
We are. Our campus is located really close to the Phoenix Art Museum. We have one large central campus where families from all over the community come and participate. We are on the public transportation lines, which helps with some of the transportation challenges, but we have families from, you know, Buckeye, from Peoria, from Glendale, from Mesa, all over the valley that come to participate in our program.
Well, I love what the organization is all about, and I know we only had a few minutes here today to cover it, but thank you for coming in. Becky Bell Ballard is with Rosie's House, and if you want to find out more about the organization, the website is rosieshouse.org. And thank you also for joining us for Sunday Sunrise, a public affairs show produced locally by Intercom Phoenix. I'm Minnie Salas, your host. Have a great Sunday.